You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 13th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hola.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, everyone. It was May 15th when Johannes Kepler, in 1816, confirmed his discovery of the third law of planetary motion.
Which was?
Which was that...
The planets move.
Yes, the planets do.
Don't put him on the spot like that.
Come on, you can't mention the third law of planetary motion without telling people what it is.
The squares of the periodic times are to each other as the cubes of the mean distances.
I think the first one is planets travel in ellipses around the sun, with the sun at one focus.
Yep.
Right? Yeah, right.
So the second one is what you said, Bob, that planets will sweep out equal areas in equal time. And the third one is the relationship between the distance and the period.
That's right. So basically, planets that are more distant from the sun have longer orbital periods than the closer planet.
Right. And he used the observations of Tycho Brahe, actually, to confirm
his
predictions. Yeah, it's cool.
Who was that? Luca Brasi, Steve?
Luca Brasi.
And Isaac Newton, based on Kepler's laws, was able to come up with his own laws of motion and of gravitation, derived from the work that Kepler did. So it's all related. It's all in the family. It's all good.
It's all good. Yep, it's all good.
Giants.
Yep.
Well, speaking of space, we have an awesome interview coming up later in the show with Rusty Swikert, who was an Apollo 9 astronaut. But first, some news items. First, we're going to start with an update on Simon Singh's lawsuit.
Unfortunately, the update is that it's not so good.
Yeah.
Simon is a longtime friend of SGU, but for those listeners who aren't aware of what's been going on, in 2008, he was sued for libel by the British Chiropractic Association because of a column he wrote in The Guardian in which he criticized them quite heavily. And the laws are very different in the UK compared to the US. Here in the US, the burden of proof is on the accuser. If you accuse someone of libeling you, you have to prove that the comments that they published were untrue, completely unfounded, and dangerous, or at least dangerous to your reputation. In the UK, unfortunately, the burden of proof is on the defense. If the British Chiropractic Association brings this lawsuit against Simon, then it's up to Simon to prove that what he said was true. Now, what he said was that the BCA has made bogus claims, and that word bogus has been the real problem here. Unfortunately, in this preliminary hearing that just went down last week, the judge ruled that when Simon used the word bogus, he implied that not only was the BCA wrong in what they said, but that they meant to be wrong, that they knowingly published lies. And this isn't just the standard chiropractic makes your back feel better line. Simon was referring to claims that chiropractic could cure diseases, particularly diseases in children, things that really did have no basis in reality. And calling them bogus was perfectly reasonable. Unfortunately, the judge did not think so and felt that in order for Simon to win the case, he had to prove that the BCA not only said these things, but and not only were these things wrong, but that they knew that these things were wrong. And proving that will be incredibly difficult. So this was a setback for Simon's case. But we're hoping that it certainly looks at this point that as if Simon is going to continue to fight this thing, which is great, not just because of the importance to fighting the Chiropractic Association from making dangerous claims, which is very important, but also from a free speech standpoint, because there are some serious problems with the way it's done in the UK, and it could certainly use an overhaul. So hopefully Simon will stand up where other journalists wouldn't have necessarily the time or the resources to fight something like this. So I know that we're all really supporting him.
Yeah, so that Judge Eady, I mean, what a ridiculous decision. This guy apparently has a history of making bad decisions in libel cases. He's just a loose cannon, I guess, of a judge. So Simon just got unlucky to draw this guy. I mean, basically telling Simon, no, that's not what you meant when you used the word bogus. This is what you meant. Even though in the same article, he says exactly what he meant by the word bogus, that he meant that these treatments don't work.
Yeah. All the judge had to do was keep reading the article to get what he was saying, but he didn't even put in that much effort. I mean, obviously, the whole system needs an overhaul.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. It's very anti-free speech.
It's nothing like this in America. Not even close.
It's better. Although, you know, clearly the British Chiropractic Association is using this to intimidate people from criticizing them, right? They're trying to have a chilling effect on any kind of open public criticism of what they do and their claims. And unfortunately, it can work, you know, because not many people can afford to defend themselves, even if they're correct. It's terrible. Well, let's move on to the next news item. Bob, you're going to tell us about ultra-dense deuterium.
You guys know that list of potential future fuels you hear so much about, you know, hydrogen, biofuel, compressed oxygen, water, Bigfoot droppings, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, now there's another one you may not be aware of. It's called ultra-dense deuterium. This is 100,000 times heavier than water, so heavy that a cube with 10 centimeter sides would weigh 130 metric tons. And get this, it's denser than the core of the sun.
Yeah,
what?
Wow.
Where does this stuff exist?
Is this like a giant ball of red floating matter in the middle of a magnetic field?
Yeah, right? Oh, that's
a
good one.
I love real science.
Do we have any of that stuff on Earth in a lab? Or
Yes, at Walmart you can get it in the deuterium aisle.
That's what these scientists are claiming. These are scientists in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. They claim that they have created this stuff, this ultra dense deuterium. If you guys have heard of deuterium, I'm sure.
Yeah,
it's deuterium is basically an isotope of hydrogen.
Yeah, hydrogen.
The nucleus contains a proton plus a neutron.
It's neutron, yeah.
Right, whereas hydrogen atom, on the other hand, contains only a proton in its nucleus. Now, this deuterium, it's not a rare isotope. There's one deuterium atom for every 6,500 hydrogen atoms in the ocean. So there's a lot of this stuff available. So now if we have this deuterium isotope, what if you'd replaced hydrogen in the H2O and make water? That's heavy water, and I'm sure you've probably heard of heavy water as well. Heavy water is just basically water that's primarily D2O as opposed to H2O. This is kind of interesting material here. The water made of D2O, heavy water, is, as you imagine, it's heavier than regular water by almost 11%. And imagine if you make ice cubes out of this stuff, the ice cubes actually sink as opposed to regular ice cubes, which float, which is kind of an important distinction, right? If we had D2O oceans on the Earth, heavy water oceans, we'd have some big problems because ice...
Well, the oceans would freeze from the bottom up.
Right, and then they could freeze solid and because it's water, ice as it is now, it creates a nice layer on top of the ocean or wherever, and wherever it freezes, and it kind of insulates the water underneath it. So, of course, the fish and anything down there can survive a lot longer.
Can we actually drink heavy water? I mean, is that poisonous?
Actually, if somebody gives you a heavy water energy drink, I would not drink it. It wouldn't hurt you, Jay. If you had a bottle, just 8 ounces or whatever, it wouldn't hurt you really. You actually have 5 grams of it in your body right now. But the problem is, I wouldn't take a 6-pack or a case of it, because if 25 to 50% of your body's water was replaced with it, then it becomes toxic, and you would die. You would die if it reached that zone of between 25 and 50%. And this is because you think, oh, big deal, you're just throwing in a neutron in there, but it alters the bond energy of the hydrogen-oxygen, deuterium-oxygen in the water. So the bond energy is a little bit different. So you throw in one little extra Jimmy neutron, and it changes the physical and the chemical properties of the molecule, which, of course, includes the biological properties. So, of course, bacteria, they can withstand it. They don't have too much of a problem with it. They grow a little more slowly, but eukaryotes like you and I, it becomes toxic very quickly. So so don't drink it. You may be asking yourself, well, how do they make this ultra-heavy deuterium? What's the deal with that? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know how they make this stuff.
For what purpose?
They're not releasing too many details about it. But the purpose is some scientists think that it plays a role in the formation of stars. So there are it may have a very important role in the universe. For us, though, it can turn out to be something very important for us. As I implied, it could be a future fuel for us because people do claim that it has the highest energy content of any combustion fuel, and it makes sense because, like I said, this is some dense shit. This stuff is incredibly, incredibly dense. To give you an example, I kept coming across in my research mention of bond distance, and this is basically it's the distance between the nuclei of the atoms that are bonded together. And for a lot of atoms, when they bond with other atoms, the bond distance may be something like 150 or 180 or 200 picometers, which is a trillionth of a meter. So this is really, really, really tiny. 150, 200. But for ultra-dense deuterium, the bond length is about 2.3 picometers instead of, say, 150 or 100, or I saw 90 for some elements, but it doesn't get much lower than in the 90s. So this is 2.3. So this is really dense stuff. The atoms are really... Everything's really, really close together, so which makes it dense, and it makes sense that would make it would give it such a really high energy content. But you're not going to throw this stuff in your fireplace for energy, but you may be able to throw it into your fusion reactor, and that's where a lot of these scientists are seeing some potential. One of the researchers, his name is Leif Holmlid. He's a professor in the Department of Chemistry. He says that one important justification for our research is that ultra-dense deuterium may be a very efficient fuel in laser-driven nuclear fusion. It is possible to achieve nuclear fusion between deuterium nuclei using high-powered lasers releasing vast amounts of energy. Now, you guys know there's lots of different types of fusion technology that scientists are working on. There's cold fusion, which is pretty much bunk. There's magnetic confinement fusion, like the tokamak, where they basically build this huge donut torus shape that uses magnetic confinement to contain the plasma that's created.
And there's Asian fusion as well, which involves smashing together Japanese and Chinese and Thai, and it's delicious.
And there's British fusion, that new dance craze that's going on.
Oh, wait, hang on. Let me write those down. I hadn't heard of those. There's another one called inertial confinement fusion. This one's pretty cool. They basically shoot lasers at a tiny small pellet of fuel that basically makes it implode and creating lots of heat and pressure, kind of like the center of the sun. And in fact, the U.S. National Ignition Facility has a setup that uses 192 lasers. Imagine 192 lasers arrayed around this fuel trying to cause fusion. Leif Holmlid has, regarding this, he said that if we can produce large quantities of ultra-dense deuterium, the fusion process may become the energy source of the future, and it may become available much earlier than we thought possible. Now, Holmlid and his homies, they think they can tweak this process to make it safer so that the byproducts are harmless, like hydrogen and helium, which would be really cool. And they also think that they can avoid using tritium in the process, which is tritium is kind of like the evil cousin of deuterium. It has one proton and two neutrons, and this makes it radioactive. So they think they can make it so that they can avoid using tritium, which would be really cool. But this is where the good news ends, and then there's lots of buts. There's lots of buts and lots of skepticism with a lot of the claims that these guys are making. Holmlid himself said that it's very difficult to make the dense deuterium in any volume, because the temperature needs to be very, very cold, something like 14 degrees Kelvin, which is really down there, getting close to absolute zero. In fact, they've claimed to have made only microscopic amounts of it. They're not even claiming that they've made much of it at all. And even this may be a vast overstatement. I came across one commenter who was saying that microscopic implies what? That you could see it in a microscope. But the way they were creating this stuff, they were measuring the energy of fleeting particles spectroscopically. So I don't know how they can measure something so tiny and then round it up by describing it as microscopic. It seemed a little bit of an overstatement there. And even more problematic is the lifetime of this stuff. They're saying that it only lasts for nanoseconds or less. This means, with a lifetime like nanoseconds, billionths of seconds, this means that you'd have to actually produce the stuff within the laser fusion reactor itself. That just sounds like it's going to introduce tons and tons of complications if it's even possible. So this doesn't sound very easy at all. And there's even other problems that I'm not going into. Some people were very, very skeptical about this.
Yeah.
I really do hope this works. Fusion energy has been 50 years away for far too long. But I'll end it with one commenter that kind of made me laugh. His name was Matt. He said that, "I'm skeptical. This sounds like a hopelessly exotic material and a scientist's attempt to grab the spotlight and get funding." That might sum it up nicely, I think. It's really speculative. The claims are a little overblown, it seems. And there's lots of unknowns. And if it works out, great.
If it could work as advertised, it would be awesome. And there's nothing impossible about this material or
correct
using it as an energy source if you can get it to fuse. It's just, you know, non-trivial engineering and technical problems that may or may not be solvable. And again,
right,
as you say, there's far enough in the future to be simply unpredictable at this point.
So it's plausible and worth the research.
Well, let's talk about something that's not plausible and not worth the research. One of my favorite topics to trash on is acupuncture. And there was another study that was published. This, I actually like this study in that it provides a tremendous amount of evidence that acupuncture doesn't work. But guess what? The press release and the researchers are spinning this to say the exact opposite of what it actually says.
They can't lose.
They
can't
lose. Yeah. They're trying to do the heads I win, tails you lose scenario. So listen to this study.
Yeah,
listen to this study. The acupuncture for chronic lower back pain. And they had four arms to this study, four groups of into which 638 patients were randomized. One group got cookbook acupuncture, meaning, you know, the placement of the needles was in some standard configuration. The second group got individualized acupuncture, where an expert acupuncturist decided, based upon all the principles of acupuncture, where to specifically place the needles for that person's symptoms. The third group got placebo acupuncture with toothpicks, mm-hmm, inside a glass tube, and the acupuncturist would just put pressure on the toothpicks and turn them to simulate the sensation of an acupuncture needle, but without any skin penetration.
Very clever.
All of those three groups also got whatever standard therapy they were getting for their lower back pain. And then there was a fourth group that got just standard therapy alone with no type of acupuncture, right? So guess what the results show? The three groups that got some form of acupuncture, and standardized, individualized, and fake or placebo acupuncture, all had the same exact results. No difference among those three groups. They all did better than the standard therapy alone with no additional, you know, intervention, acupuncture-like intervention, right?
Yep.
So the press releases, of course, say that even fake acupuncture works than standard therapy. Oh, God.
What?
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Subtitle, we have no idea how the placebo effect works.
Exactly. I mean, it's just, you know, it's an abomination of scientific logic, right? What's science all about? Science is all about isolating variables so that you can say what those variables mean, right? What effect that they're having. So if we isolate the variable of where you stick the needles, it turns out that variable doesn't matter at all. And we can go beyond this study, right? Lots of other studies, if you compare sham to real acupuncture. The bottom line is, if you look at the bulk of the research, it shows that it doesn't seem to matter where you place the needles. If you look at placebo acupuncture using the specially designed needles, and in this study, it's just a nice little touch that it was toothpicks, right? Then it doesn't matter if the needles are actually penetrate the skin or not. So it doesn't even matter if you stick needles through the skin. Doesn't matter where you put them, doesn't matter if you put them. It's just the ritual surrounding the acupuncture that seems to have the measurable effect. So if you look at it this way, what are the two variables that are specific to acupuncture? What is acupuncture? It's sticking the needles in acupuncture points.
Right. Well, there goes their whole mechanism.
Of course.
The meridians and all that is out the window now.
Well, the traditional Chinese medicine philosophy of acupuncture, of qi and meridians, that's been gone for years. But yes, this study is yet more evidence that that's all BS, because it doesn't matter if you individualize your treatment based upon those principles. It has no measurable effect, right? So the two variables that are specific to acupuncture have no effect. Therefore, acupuncture has no effect. Acupuncture doesn't work. That's the only thing this study was really designed to test, to compare those variables. And it shows with zero effect of anything that you can reasonably call acupuncture.
But Steve, did you just say before, because I'm still kind of, my brain is trying to wrap itself around that ridiculous statement.
Yeah.
Did you say before that when they were told those results, they said, yeah, but even when it doesn't work, it works better than not doing it?
Well, so there's two levels of insanity in terms of the press release, right? Which, and if you read the news reports, everyone got it wrong. Toothpick acupuncture works. Acupuncture, real or fake, helps aching back. You know, acupuncture is better than standard therapy for back pain, even when it's fake. Wrong! That's not what this study shows. That's not what it was designed to even look at. First of all, they make one big mistake. The three acupuncture arms were acupuncture plus standard therapy compared to standard therapy, right? It wasn't acupuncture versus standard therapy. It was acupuncture plus standard therapy versus standard therapy. That's a completely different kind of comparison, right? So you can't conclude that acupuncture works better than standard therapy. You can only say that the thing that was in common to all three of those quote-unquote acupuncture groups had an added benefit to the standard therapy alone. What did those three groups have in common? It wasn't placing needles through the skin. It wasn't where you place the needles. It was the placebo effect surrounding the ritual of getting a novel therapy. It wasn't even really designed to say that acupuncture itself has to be the novel therapy, because they didn't compare it to introducing other novel therapies, right?
Yeah.
So all you could say is that there was a placebo effect in addition to the standard therapy. That's it. You can't conclude anything else. You can conclude that there was a placebo effect and that acupuncture doesn't work. That's what this study shows.
Yeah, so basically when you're getting fake acupuncture and they actually don't even apply the fake acupuncture, it works better than if you do nothing.
Well, this wasn't comparing it with nothing, right? Just again, just to be clear.
No, I'm just trying to confuse you because the whole thing is ridiculous.
Yeah. This is all compatible with a pure placebo effect, right?
Yeah.
You're introducing a novel therapy to a patient. Typically, people involved with these studies have some desire for them to work. It's done by proponents. The subjects are probably proponents. Whatever. It's also just, you know, say so, there's copious studies showing that there are placebo effects from doing stuff to patients, right? And the more invasive it is, the greater the placebo effect, you know? So doing something that's physically manipulative, like poking the skin with needles, it has more of a placebo effect than taking a pill, for example.
There should have been a fourth arm to that, Steve. They should have done something completely unrelated to acupuncture, like have the doctor come in with a tricorder and a hypo spray say, "Yep, oh, well, you're cured after going through that." And
not even the doctor, just a hypnotist come in and say, "Look at my watch, you're feeling
better." But
Bob, better.
They would have just said, "Well, that works too, apparently."
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but it would have been more blatant, you know, that you used these Star Trek toys to cure somebody. They would have, you know, maybe would have drove home the fact that, wait a second, there's a whole placebo thing going on here.
Yeah. But this, it shows the utter either self-deception or other deception on the part of the acupuncture industry, if you will, acupuncture proponents. You know, they're taking a negative study and they're trying to sell it to the public as showing that their therapy works when it shows that it doesn't work. Can you imagine a pharmaceutical company trying to get FDA approval that worked for a drug that works exactly the same as a placebo, and their defense is, well, the placebo works too. And they're both better than doing nothing. Therefore, our drug works. It works as well as a placebo. Therefore, let's get FDA approval for it. Could you imagine a pharmaceutical company doing that? It's ridiculous. It completely flies in the face of the very concept of doing a placebo-controlled trial to isolate variables and see if those variables mean anything or do anything.
So the acupuncture proponents are relying on the public's misunderstanding of the placebo effect.
Yes, and science and the way clinical trials, the logic behind clinical trials, yes. All of that.
Wield that in their favor. Well,
and the press, you know, and the media is just passing it along absolutely uncritically.
Uncritically.
Now that's probably
terrible.
The worst part of all this.
It is the worst part, but Evan, are you surprised at all? Even
no,
a little bit?
No, no, nothing surprises me with the media these days.
Who got it right?
I expect bad things. And
I have not personally seen one mainstream media outlet that got it right.
Oh, God. Wow.
Not a single one. I may have missed one out there, but I looked at 20 or 30 of them. They all said the same thing.
And they still have science writers, departments or something. I mean,
They're shrinking, but yeah.
Hopefully some of the commenters raising got it right.
So what this means is that you do not need to spend years studying acupuncture to know where to place needles.
Right.
What this means is that you can randomly poke somebody with a toothpick and get the same effect that you would out of all of the nonsense behind acupuncture.
And I don't even need a license for that.
I think this means that it's medically unethical to actually stick an acupuncture needle through somebody's skin.
Right.
Because you're using an invasive procedure that has no proven added benefit, that has been shown not to be any more effective than not penetrating the skin.
And you're delaying the patient from getting some real help.
Well, that's the bigger issue, is that this is all nonsense, and this shows that it's nonsense, and it doesn't deserve to be researched further. Now, what's interesting, I'll tell you, is that in the actual study, the published study itself, the authors have to be a little circumspect, right? Because now they need to get and this is probably the result of the peer review process, right? When you submit an article, it almost never gets published without some revision. So I'm sure the peer review process made them throw in some reasonable caveats in their interpretation of the data, but they still were wishy-washy. This is what the authors wrote. Although acupuncture was found effective for chronic low back pain, that's wrong. This study did not show that. They continue, tailoring needling sites to each patient and penetration of the skin appear to be unimportant in eliciting therapeutic benefits. These findings raise questions about acupuncture's purported mechanisms of action. It blows them out of the water. Yep. And it remains unclear whether acupuncture or our simulated method of acupuncture provide physiologically important stimulation or represent placebo or nonspecific effects.
Unclear.
They stepped up to the truth there. It's not unclear. It's clear that it provides nothing but placebo and nonspecific effects.
Steve, I don't even think they'd back down if they took an acupuncture needle, put it in someone, and they literally exploded. Maybe at that point you might get a few that go, well, all right. But even still, there'd be some idiot arguing that, well, you never know. We got to do more studies.
It needs more study, right? That's always if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, it needs more study.
Needs more studies,
right? If it doesn't work, well, that's just because the placebo works, and we need more study. Okay. No, it doesn't work. Get over it. Move on. You know,
Steve, is any drug company just made a drug called placebo?
You could buy placebos.
No, but is it called placebo
as a brand name?
Yeah,
I don't think so. I don't think that there's any placebo. Any placebo as a brand name.
That would be awesome.
Jay just trademarked it, everyone, so. Copyright 2009 Skeptics Guide to the Universe.
Because people are so stupid, you could be like, well, all these placebo effects, I'm selling placebo.
Yeah, and claim all the effects that placebos are shown to have. Yeah. That's what placebo medicine is. That would be identical to the claims that are being made for acupuncture or homeopathy or whatever, or any placebo medicine.
Call it Placebex, or, you know, they just
Placebex.
Take a name and you throw an X at the end of it.
Placebian.
Unbelievable.
We just have to take stuff like this on the chin all the time. It's like, you know, we get a great study is performed. It's done very well. Not only does the press screw it up, but no matter what you show, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And you know what the sad thing is if they did this study and they actually proved that acupuncture works, we would all be like, oh, okay, well, we were wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, it works.
All right, well, let's move on.
Here we go.
Just one more quick news item. The space shuttle Atlantis is currently in orbit around our lovely planet. And do you know what it's doing up there?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
It's in free fall.
That's true.
Is it?
More or less.
Let's hope not.
It's on the fifth and final mission to repair and upgrade the Hubble Space Telescope. This is the last repair mission for the Hubble. The Hubble, apparently most of its gyros aren't working anymore. So we're going to replace some of the gyros. The gyros are what enable NASA to actually move the scope and aim it at things. So that That would be nice. And they're replacing some fried electrical equipment and a camera or two, I think. They're going to install a fresh thermal covers on the telescope and a new science data control unit. This mission's costing $1 billion. And if completed successfully, at the moment that they've successfully grabbed the Hubble and put it into the bay of the shuttle, they should get another 5 to 10 years of service out of the Hubble.
Wow!
And then that will be it. Then the Hubble will simply, it'll just slowly break down, and there will be no more repair missions, and then it'll eventually be a useless hunk of metal in orbit.
So from what I read, they actually docked it onto the space shuttle.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the arm attached today, and they brought it in successfully.
Now, NASA almost didn't do this mission because it's so dangerous. The most dangerous aspect of this mission is the fact that the shuttle has to go into an orbit, into the same orbit as the Hubble Space Telescope, which means it will be inaccessible to the space station.
Yeah.
Therefore, if something goes wrong with the shuttle and they can't re-enter, then they won't be able to park the astronauts in the space station until they can rescue them. For that reason, they have the Endeavour on the launch pad ready to go up at a moment's notice on a rescue mission. And that's the protocol they came up with, and that's what salvaged this mission, is enabling them to go on this final repair mission for Hubble.
You know, I follow anything that happens to do with launches to space and everything, and I don't remember reading them preparing a second ship as a backup.
Yes, that's correct. The Endeavour's on the pad. And that's all been since the Columbia disaster.
Yeah.
That's a new protocol.
Right.
Since the Columbia blew up on reentry.
Yeah.
They can't prep a shuttle and just have it sit there ready to go and just have it be idle for a long time. Like, you know, things actually degrade after a while. It's not just that, Bob, but they can't just park it there in launch position ready to roll. You know, there's like a window where you could launch it, and then you have to pull it down again and re-prep it.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. Plus, this mission is actually somewhat risky, riskier than usual. One reason is that the repairs that they're doing to the Hubble require not simply, you know, putting in new instruments or replacing instruments, but they're actually doing the equivalent of open-heart surgery. They're opening up certain aspects of Hubble and replacing circuit boards and things that were never meant to be replaced this way.
Yeah.
You know, they were meant to be replaced modularly, not in the way that they're doing it. So that's adding some risk to the actual success because it's never been done. The other risky part that is getting a lot of play in the news is that the orbit that they're in has got an extra, you know, extra orbital debris, space junk floating around, and they're concerned that the longer they're there, the greater the risk that the shuttle could be hit with some
right.
debris that's in orbit. That's another risk. And then, of course, we all know now that there's like a 21-inch scratch on the tiles on one of the wings from the launch. And that had some concern, but now they're pretty convinced that it's very minor, and they don't even have to even look at it again.
Yeah, they're shallow and not on a very vulnerable part. Yeah,
Bob, you know the official and secret name of this mission was the Hubble Hubbub.
The Hubble Hubbub.
Hubble Hubbub. Yeah. I like it.
Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Rusty Schweikert. Rusty, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
And Rusty is an astronaut. You were actually on the Apollo 9 mission. But he is here to talk to us tonight primarily about his recent work, Protecting the Earth from Asteroids. So, Rusty, why don't you just start by giving us an overview of this project that you're working on?
Well, I've been working the issue in general since 2001. Basically wearing two different hats. One hat, a bunch of us are looking at the technical challenge of deflecting asteroids that would be headed for an impact. With another hat, I'm working with a group of astronauts and cosmonauts who are dealing with the issue of the international community making a decision to deflect or not to deflect an asteroid that develops as a threat. Those are two different things, the technology and the decision-making.
Right. And So let's actually talk first about the politics of it. So you're interfacing directly with the UN, trying to create essentially what sounds like an international readiness to deal with an impending impact if we discover that there's about to be one, right?
Yes, except that you made it sound as though it's just about to hit, as opposed to that we know that there's a threat, which could be 10 years or 15 or 20 years or more in the future.
Right.
The nice thing about orbital mechanics compared with something like climate or something like that is that it behaves very nicely. It's a, you know, it's a very orderly process, F equals MA and Newton and all of that, you know. So orbital mechanics is a very predictable thing, and once you discover a near-Earth object and track it for a bit, you can plot its future path for, you know, a century.
That's right. So we may have years, even decades of warning. However, because we haven't yet tracked all of the near-Earth objects, sometimes we realize that we've had a close call only after the asteroid has already passed the nearest point, right? So right now we could be taken with very short notice.
Well, any of the ones you haven't discovered yet, of the million or so out there that are, you know, potentially dangerous to us, can hit at any time. You know, they can totally surprise us, which is why the early warning program or the search program is so very important. Because once you've discovered them, all the ones that can do you damage, then it's a matter of tracking them for any changes in their orbit. But once you've got them all in your database, it's a matter of just keeping track of them and making sure that they're still in the same orbit, that something hasn't, you know, caused a change, which you then need to update and run another set of predictions on.
Yeah, but even after we say, even after we fill up our database of objects and we think we've got everything, aren't there certain classes of comets that come in on certain trajectories that really enter the system pretty quickly, giving us, even if we find it very quickly, it would give us very little time to react?
Oh, yeah. If you want to talk about comets, I'm going to give you another name and a telephone number and you can call him.
Okay.
Because comets are not something which we can really deal with today. Now, luckily, comets are few and far between. The total threat is 100 times greater from near-Earth objects, near-Earth asteroids. We lump together near-Earth asteroids and near-Earth comets and call them near-Earth objects, or NEOs. Okay. But the long-period comets, the ones that come in from out beyond Jupiter's orbit, we don't see them until they're fairly close, unlike the near-Earth objects, which we, you know, which circulate around the sun every year or two or three. A long-period comet may, you know, not come around in its period for 80 or 100 or 200 years or even more. So it's not a matter of knowing them. You know, they're not neighbors. These are sort of interlopers from overseas or something. You know, they're not neighbors. The near-Earth objects which dominate the impact threat are neighbors. They circulate around the sun the same way we do. You know, their orbits happen to cross the orbit of the Earth, and therefore every once in a while we end up at an intersection at the same time. But ultimately, the tougher question is, you know, I often put it, you know, you can know what's coming at you, you can have something to do about it, but somebody's got to make a decision to do it, and that's not a national decision. It's an international issue intrinsically, and therefore the world community has got to make the decision, and that's the tough part.
And how is the international community reacting to these discussions? Is it something that people are taking seriously?
Well, that small part of the international community with whom we've been in contact and who have become aware of the issue and informed about it are very interested, and they're taking it quite seriously. However, that's a very, very small portion of the international community. I mean, we're dealing with the element of the United Nations that deals with outer space activities, and that's called COPUS, or the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, or affectionately known as the Outer Space Committee of the United Nations. That's the group of people who, over the last 40 years, have developed all of the space treaty, the international space treaties that exist. And they're the ones that we're bringing this to. You know, it's an international community that has to make the decision, but there's only one organization that really represents almost everybody in the world, and that is the United Nations. Nobody likes things, you know, especially something that's, life and death matter, and it requires timely, crisp decision-making to go to the United Nations. You know, there isn't anybody else. There is no other organization. So that's who we're working with, and we're trying to, frankly, set precedent in getting the United Nations to a point where it can make a quick decision by essentially dealing with all of the issues ahead of time and, you know, in a sense, gaming it out so that when a real threat arises, you fit it into the policies and structures that you've already worked out and you can make a quick decision. But whether that happens or not before we get hit, that's another question. But at least we're trying.
So this committee's taking it seriously, the Outer Space Committee of the UN.
But at the moment, yeah.
It hasn't really gone beyond that, is what you're saying.
No, not yet. In fact, while I have been working with the United Nations for over 3 years now on this, and by the way, when I say I, what I'm really doing is representing the Association of Space Explorers. That's our professional organization of astronauts and cosmonauts, and I head our Committee on Near-Earth Objects. And so I have been representing all of the astronauts and cosmonauts and bringing this to the attention of the United Nations for the past 3 years. Well, in that process, we got together a group of international experts, and we brought these people together over a period of 2 years, and we've developed a report, which is online, by the way. That report I presented formally to the Scientific and Technical Subcommittee of the Outer Space Committee in February of this year, and in fact in another couple weeks, in June, I'll be presenting the report that we developed, which is a decision process that we're proposing, to the full Outer Space Committee in Vienna. But, you know, the UN works very slowly, but like a lot of bureaucracies, once it gets going, it will see things through. I mean, you get a certain amount of momentum in the United Nations, and it just keeps going.
Rusty, at this stage in the game, do you even go into what technology you would use to do early detection?
Well, the answer is yes, but not necessarily with the United Nations. That is, the decision process of taking an action to address a threat, either to ignore a threat, which is actually an action, obviously, you just decide to take the hit. Right? That's a decision that has to be made. Or you decide to intervene, to do something. So the decision is somewhat separate from, not entirely, but somewhat separate from the two other technical issues of finding them or discovering them and the deflection techniques or deflection capability. Both of those things enter in a little bit to the early warning process, you know, if the United Nations is going to issue a warning to, you know, Rome to evacuate because there's an asteroid that's likely to hit, you know, in the next 48 or 72 hours, you're not going to do that lightly. I mean, that's got to be based on, you know, very serious information that you've got high confidence in. So you do need to understand and have confidence in the technical issues. But the United Nations is not going to run a search program. Mm-hmm. They're going to take the information that's developed, by universities or by independent observing systems and things of that kind, like, you know, JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, runs a whole series of telescopes right now called the Space Guard Survey. You know, the Italians are part of this process. I mean, there are people all around the world, including amateurs, who are part of this whole observing process that goes on every day, every night. But they've got to enter into an official, sanctioned, verified database out of which official decisions get made.
And that database doesn't exist yet.
Well, it exists, but it does not have any sanctioning other than NASA, for example. I mean, somebody has got to eventually bring all of this together in a coordinated information network, which is one of the things we've recommended to the United Nations, the formation of an official information analysis and warning network.
Do Do you have an estimate right now of what percentage of the near-Earth objects have been mapped?
Oh, yeah, sure. But I can't give you a number unless you give me a size.
I see. So let's say, well, is there a size that's generally agreed upon as this is big enough to worry about?
Not exactly. We have made in our report, and this is, again, the Association of Space Explorers report to the United Nations, we've made the assumption that the Tunguska event that occurred in Siberia 100 years ago, you know, last June, that was about, you know, the equivalent of 250 to 400 Hiroshima bombs going off in one place at one time.
Wow.
Okay, and that is about the smallest thing that we worry about.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not official. I mean, that's about a 40-meter diameter object, you know, what, 150 feet in diameter, something like that, a little less. But so a 40-meter diameter object is about the size that you would worry about. That, again, is about like 350 or something like that, plus or minus, Hiroshima bombs. We consider that to be the smallest, and there are about 600,000. You know, I'm giving you error bars on this. There are about 600,000 to a million of those objects that are near, that cross the orbit of the Earth. You know, near Earth objects of that size.
Damn.
And of those, we've only found about 0.5%.
Oh boy.
Okay.
Okay. Now, if you go up to things that can cause global disaster, that's about 1 kilometer to 2 kilometers in diameter. And there are about 1,000 of those objects. And we've discovered about 82% of those so far. If you go up to the dinosaur killers, you know, you're talking 10 kilometers in diameter, and we know of all of them. That's 100%.
Yeah.
Is there a lot of those? Like, what did we have, a half dozen of those or something?
No, even less than that. There are probably two or three of that size, and we've discovered all them. Now, you know, there can always be a lurker somewhere, but basically, you know, you find the bigger ones first. That's pretty obvious, and because of the, you know, the power law distribution of these things, the frequency distribution, the smaller ones, there are many more of the smaller ones than there are of the big ones. So the big ones, you're talking about, you know, a few tens of them. The mid-size, you know, you're talking about several thousand of them. And the smallest size that can hurt us, you know, where the atmosphere doesn't protect us, you're talking about, you know, 500,000 to a million of them.
You know, I'm really surprised to hear that something only 40 meters long could actually do that much damage.
It's all kinetic energy.
Yeah, right. Square the velocity, man. It's coming at you, you know, 10 times the speed of a high-speed bullet. I mean, that's it's really hauling his butt, you know. So it's got a lot of energy when it hits.
Rusty, do you have at your fingertips what, if we do nothing, when will a Tunguska-level event likely happen?
On average.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking Las Vegas, right? I can't tell you that. What I can tell you is the frequency with which one of that size hits. And the frequency is about once every 300 to 500 years. But that could be tomorrow or it could be 1,000 years from now. I mean, you know. The next one. So, but that's the frequency, about once every 300 to 500 years. But look at, guys, here's a more interesting part. If you look at it from the geopolitical perspective, you look at it from the perspective of a decision maker. Okay, you say to yourself, not how often does one hit, but how often will I have to make a decision of whether or not to intervene?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that is a different story because in many cases, you don't have really great tracking data. And so in many cases, we're going to have to make decisions of whether or not to intervene when the probability of an impact is, let's say, 1 in 50.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you have to make a decision when the probability is 1 in 50, and you have something that happens once every 500 years, that means every 10 years you're going to have to make a decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm.
Right.
That's why we're telling the United Nations, hey guys, the frequency of these things actually hitting is low, but you're going to have to make decisions at 50 times the frequency that they hit. Wow. So you've got to get ready because you're going to have to make decisions in the next 10 to 15 years.
That's
and you better be
point.
Ready for it.
Excellent, yeah.
Rusty, do you have a favorite method of all the methods that have been speculated about how we would deflect an asteroid if we saw a big one coming?
You know, the reality of the thing is not a method. The reality is that you have to use a combination of things. The reason for that is somewhat subtle. If we're talking about a big one, and let's talk about a big one that is headed for what I refer to as a direct impact.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to deflect. You're going to have to make it arrive early or late. In other words, if you think of this as an intersection in space, a three-dimensional intersection in space, two lines crossing, the issue is to, given that, you know, if you don't do anything, the Earth and the asteroid are going to arrive in the intersection at the same time. The challenge is to go up to the asteroid and change its orbital period so that it arrives at the intersection or it goes through the intersection before the Earth gets there, or the Earth goes through the intersection before the asteroid gets to the intersection. So you either have to increase its orbital period or decrease its orbital period so that it arrives something like 16 minutes different from what it would 25 years from now, you know, at that time when it would have impacted. And you do that by making a very, very small change in its velocity. So you need to use something big. You got to run into it with a kinetic impact. You just take a spacecraft, heavy as you can, get it going as fast as you can, and you rear end the asteroid. You just run into the sucker. And that will make it miss the Earth. The problem with that is it's like a meat cleaver. It's effective, but it's a very blunt instrument. I mean, it's a very crude instrument. So you know you can make it miss the Earth, let's say, but you don't know whether it's going to miss the Earth by 2 Earth radii or by 10 Earth radii. And there's no way you can tell ahead of time because, you know, if it hits something fluffy in the asteroid, it does one thing. If it hits a solid piece of an asteroid, it does another. If it hits it a glancing blow, you know, there's all kinds of different things. So it's a very blunt sort of instrument. So what you can say is it's going to miss the Earth, but it's going to come close to the Earth, somewhere between 2 and 10 Earth radii away at the time it would have impacted. Now, the subtlety in this thing is that there are resonance points both in front of and behind the Earth that are called keyholes, little regions of space where when anything comes near the Earth, it has a danger or a potential for passing through one of these narrow regions where the Earth's gravity will change the period of the asteroid in such a way that it will come back some integral number of years later, 5, 7, 8, 9, 13, whatever. You know, there are keyholes for each of these things. And so if you want to be able to assure the world that you not only made it miss the Earth on this time, but you didn't dump it into a keyhole,
right,
which is going to bring it back 5 years from now, that you have to finish up that crude deflection with a very precise trimming maneuver. In other words, you got to pull out the scalpel,
mm-hmm,
and very precisely guarantee that it goes between keyholes and not through one. And for that precise maneuver, you use a gravity tractor or some other equivalent. But right now, the gravity tractor is an available technology.
Well, couldn't we just build an obelisk that shoots a force beam that just moves it, pushes it out of the way?
Right.
Yeah, there you go. I knew you guys would have to revert to kind.
Yeah,
right?
But it sounds like the two methods that you're talking about, one is just slamming something heavy and fast into it to push it into a different orbit, and then tweaking it with the gravity tug, which I think actually Phil Plait described for us previously, which you just park something near the asteroid and, you know, rocket.
You just hover.
And hover it.
Yeah, you just hover in front of it or behind it, right.
Rusty, before we leave, I know you don't like to dwell on the past, but I have to ask you, how totally cool was it to have a Saturn V rocket strapped to your ass?
Very.
I mean, what was that? What did that feel like blasting off into space with one of those things?
What does it feel like? You're laying there, you know, the thing lights off. It's a lot of noise, you know, right at liftoff. It's a very, you know, now you were talking Saturn V. Mm-hmm. The space shuttle is a bit different because it's got solid rockets. But on the Saturn V, you know, we had a big liquid rocket down there. When it lifts off, I mean, you know what it's like to try to balance a broom on your hand, right? You wiggle your hand around to keep your hand under the head of the broom up at the top, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's the same way. The bottom end of the rocket is moving back and forth to stay under the center of mass of that whole thing. And so you can feel this kind of hunting, you know, this sort of wobbling back and forth. But it's a very, very solid, you know, it's like the car door slamming on a Rolls Royce, not a Volkswagen. It's a very solid, secure sort of feeling. But, you know, there's no, you don't even notice the acceleration. I mean, you barely are getting off the ground. You know, thrust is just barely greater than weight.
It's not a model rocket going off.
No, but even in the case of a model rocket, you know, the highest acceleration is just before burnout of that, of each stage. Because then all of the fuel is gone from that stage.
Right.
And so your mass is way down. Your mass is, you know, six times less just before that first stage burns out. So even though you got off the ground at just a little bit over 1G, by the time you reach burnout, you're sitting up there at 6 Gs or 6.5 Gs or whatever. Wow. Now, and that's, not again, not true with the shuttle. It gets up to, what, 2.5 or 3 Gs or something like that. Mm-hmm. But with the Saturn V, yeah, you burned a hell of a lot of fuel.
So the shuttle's for girly men.
The shuttle is for wimps.
Yeah.
You know, the old boys, we had it tough. You know? it certainly lets you know that you're headed somewhere different. I mean, it's not so much the acceleration, but it's that combination of the acceleration and the length of time that you're experiencing it. And by the time you've been pulling an average of 4 G's for 10 minutes, I mean, just work it out. You're really hauling the mail. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, that's what it takes to get up to 17,000 miles an hour.
Right.
It's a pretty impressive experience. I said that, you know, right at liftoff, there's a bunch of noise. But even that disappears 10, 15 seconds after liftoff. You know, the sound is coming at you from the noise of the rocket bouncing off the ground and then bouncing up to the spacecraft at the upper end of the launch vehicle. By the time you're 10 seconds or so into the air, that's diminished to the point where you can't even hear it. And so after the initial 10 or 15 seconds of sort of vibration and noise, it gets to be very smooth.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
The biggest shock is when the engines shut off, and that's one that you science geeks would enjoy, because if you think about it, you got picture that you're in this very thin, you're at the end of this very thin-skinned aluminum tube that's 360 feet long, and you got 7 million pounds of thrust pushing on that thing. And if you figure that out, I don't know what it is, but it's probably 3 or 4 inches at least of compression.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
whoa.
Now you suddenly cut off that 7 million pounds of thrust, and all of a sudden that tube goes boink, and
whoa.
Guess who's on the far end of it?
and that's when you get thrown forward?
Yeah, and Dave Scott and I, not really having thought much about that, but having thought about the fact that, you know, our arms were overlapping and we both had to do things during the launch, you know, especially if we got into an emergency. And so after the guys strapped us into the spacecraft before liftoff, they closed the hatch and they pulled the white room back, and Dave and I looked at each other and we reached up and we loosened up our shoulder straps so we could move around a little easier.
Mm-hmm.
And then at cutoff on that first stage, all of a sudden, we went flying forward because our shoulder straps were loose. We went flying forward, and our helmet stopped about an inch from the control panel.
Oh,
jeez!
And both of us sort of looked at each other out of the corners of our eyes, and we we sort of gulped and said, well, we'll have to warn the guys about that one. but that's the way you learn. You know?
Right.
Was there a single experience from the whole thing that stands out as just the best part of it, or the most unexpected or coolest thing that you experienced?
Well, yeah, sure. For me, I think for everybody, it may be a different thing, but, for me, in my case, it was the EVA, the extravehicular activity.
Yeah.
And in my case, it was pretty dramatic. I didn't have a very long EVA compared with the stuff the guys are going to be doing the next couple of days on the Hubble.
Right. Yeah, right.
But, it was supposed to be two orbits, but the day before I had gotten sick and barfed twice. So we didn't know what was going to be happening the next day, and so we canceled the EVA. The next day, when we went through the process, we were going to go up to the point where we depressurized the spacecraft, and then pretend that we went outside, and then pick up again from where we would come in and repressurize and finish out the checklist. So we would have checked out all of the internal stuff, but we wouldn't actually do the EVA. The reason, by the way, that you don't want to do an EVA if you might be sick is because in weightlessness, barf is going to stay right around your nose and mouth.
Yep.
There isn't any gravity that's going to pull it down inside the suit. And you can't get your hands there, right, inside the suit. So the equation is a very simple one in weightlessness, in a space suit. You barf, you die.
Right.
If there's a chance of being sick, you don't take that chance. You don't go out. So that's why we canceled the EVA. But then the next day, as we got moving toward it, in fact, it was very obvious to me first, and then also, thankfully, to Jim McDivitt, that, I was past that point. I had adapted. So as we got approaching that point, we looked at each other, and Jim said, "You look like you're feeling a lot better today." And I said, "Yeah, I am." He says, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I think we could do it." And he said, "Wow. I do too." And he just called Mission Control and said, "Hey, Houston, we're going ahead with the EVA." I mean, it was the most incredible command decision I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. So that contrast from having canceled the EVA and potentially jeopardized the whole goal of John F. Kennedy to get to the moon by the end of the decade and back, from potentially jeopardizing that goal being accomplished to going out the next day, I mean, I went from the lowest point I've ever been in my life to the highest point I've ever been. Mm-hmm. So it was, mm-hmm. that was a pretty spectacular experience. And then, during the EVA, Dave Scott was taking movie pictures of me and the camera jammed. And so Dave took 5 minutes to try and unjam the camera, which he didn't. I just hung out for 5 minutes, and that was really a very precious 5 minutes of my life.
Well, Rusty, thank you so much for joining us and being so generous with your time.
Well, you're welcome. I'm sorry my voice is a little off peak, but that's okay. I think we've
managed.
You did
great. Thanks for being a trooper. And again, you said you were just coming down with some laryngitis, but you wanted to go through with it anyway, and we appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rusty.
Good luck to you guys. You're doing a great job.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one totally bogus.
Careful, which means I'm being
deceptive.
I'm going to sue you.
And you guys have to tell me which one is the fake. So here are the items. Item number one. A new study suggests that nearly all of the increase in weight in the U.S. over the last 30 years is due to increased calorie intake rather than decreased physical activity. Item number two, biologists discover a new frog species that uses bursts of infrasound to stun its prey. And item number three, researchers find in a new clinical study that 30% of cancers respond significantly to treatment with an antiviral drug. Rebecca, please go first.
I think it could go either way, and I think that's totally plausible that the increase in weight is due more to increased calories rather than decreased physical activity. But I feel like I remember reading a study that said it was the opposite, so I don't know. It seems like everybody's got a different opinion, so I think that could go either way. Discovering a new frog species that uses bursts of infrasound to stun its prey. That's pretty freaking cool. So I hope that that one's true. And we know that infrasound, I think that's the so-called brown note, right, that people have long suspected could cause someone to crap his or her pants just by hearing the sound. It's the sound that trucks make when they go over overpasses and stuff that could make you feel like there are ghosts in a room. Interesting stuff. And I think that could happen. So that one I think is true. Which brings us to 30% of cancers respond to treatment with an antiviral drug. Jeez, I am not sure that sounds like it could be plausible too. So I don't really know anything about that. Jeez, so I think I'm going to go with item one, though. I think that the increase in weight in the U.S. over the last 30 years is actually due to decreased physical activity as opposed to increased caloric intake.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so the first one, a new study suggests that nearly all of the increase in weight in the U.S. over the last 30 years is due to increased calorie intake rather than decreased physical activity. I definitely believe that. Item number two, biologists discover a new frog species that uses bursts of infrasound to stun its prey. What, Steve, is infrasound?
Sound that's too low a frequency for the humans to hear.
So like low sound is what you're saying.
And frequency.
Low frequency sound.
Yeah, right.
So they got this new frog species that uses super low sound to stun its prey. That's pretty cool. I get to see like a frog going like, whoa. Like,
more like, bruh. Right? Bruh. A hypnotoad.
And then we have researchers find in a new clinical study that 30% of cancers respond significantly to treatment with an antiviral drug. Wow. I don't know about that. That's the fake.
Okay, Evan.
All right. The increase in weight due to calorie intake rather than decreased physical activity. I don't know. The frogs for infrasound, I think that's fascinatingly true. And then 30% of cancers responding to an antiviral drug. I don't know. Cancer or calories? I'll agree with Rebecca on this one. I think that the calorie intake one is fiction.
Okay, Bob.
The calorie intake one makes sense to me. It doesn't seem to me that physical activity has changed that much. I don't think the average person gets nearly enough as they should, but it doesn't seem to me that it has decreased. The frogs that use infrasound, I don't know, just low-frequency sound doesn't seem to be is that a good stun weapon? Low-frequency sound just doesn't seem very effective. And now we've got the clinical study, 30% of cancers respond significantly. Well, what does that mean, significantly? The assumption is that it helps, but a significant response could be detrimental as well.
No, that was meant to imply favorably respond. I mean,
oh, you're going to give me that, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's not like that. Yeah, okay. I wouldn't say cancers respond to a treatment and have it mean that it makes it worse. No. This is no deception there.
I think I'll go with my gut and say that the infrasound is the fake. Oh, man, 30% of cancers respond. Oh, man, that would just be everywhere. How would they miss that?
Bob, come on.
I'm going with the infrasound.
Wait, you sure? Fake. Are you sure? Okay.
No.
Yep. All right, so you guys are all over the map this week.
Oh, we're all over the place.
Did you find that funny?
I always like that. I like that. Okay, so we'll take them. I guess we'll take them in order then, since you guys are all over the map. So, item number one: a new study suggests that nearly all of the increase in weight in the U.S. over the last 30 years is due to increased calorie intake rather than decreased physical activity. Rebecca and Evan, you both thought this one was the fiction, and this one is science.
Wow!
And it is absolutely true that this is a raging debate. exactly this question. Why are Americans getting fatter? And actually Western industrialized countries, not just the U.S. Is it because of increased calorie intake, decreased physical activity, or some combination of both? And depending on how you try to answer the question, you can come up with different responses. Well, these researchers took a fairly new approach. They actually set out to find out over the last 30 years how much food have Americans consumed by like counting up all the food that gets produced and imported into the U.S. minus all the food that gets exported by taking into consideration the population. They also did a survey of children and adults and very carefully calculated by actually following them, you know, around how many calories they burn over a period of time. So, and what they found is that the amount of food consumed by Americans actually accounts for more weight gain than the actual weight gain that has occurred over the last 30 years, suggesting that, if anything, we're maybe even a little bit more active than now than we were 30 years ago. But it's more than enough to account for all of the weight gain. So, interesting approach. Mm-hmm. This is, but again, it's one line of evidence. This is not the final. I don't mean to suggest this is the final word on this debate, on this raging question. And of course, this doesn't have any impact on the copious physical benefits of physical activity. So, very interesting.
Portion control, people.
Let's go on to number two. Number two, biologists discover a new frog species that uses bursts of infrasound to stun its prey. Bob, you thought this was fiction. Everyone else bought this one as science. And this one is the fiction.
Yes.
Good job, Bob.
Wow.
Well done.
And you hit upon the thing that I was curious if anyone was going to hit upon, Bob, that infrasound doesn't really contain a lot of energy because it's low frequency.
Right.
And I don't know that it would be a good medium for to stun a creature. Usually you use ultrasound, right, to stun.
Right. What about using nanosound?
Although, you know, you could think, all right, so frogs are amphibious. Maybe this would work more underwater. And it's not totally impossible, but if you're going to use infrasound in order to have an effect on a creature, it would have to be very intense, right? It could still be very intense infrasound.
But, Steve, if the frogs did it, what would it sound like?
Well, you wouldn't be able to hear it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And there's the paradox.
Although frogs could use weirding modules in order to amplify the sound.
Awesome. Universal transmitter.
But you know, the thing is, frogs are really small, too. Like, elephants communicate with infrasound because they have these massive vocal cords, right? So I tried really hard. I had to actually throw in the bit about stunning prey because I couldn't convince myself that I've adequately ruled out that there's any frogs anywhere that communicate by infrasound.
They are so diverse, yeah.
I couldn't find anything definitive, but there was a couple of reports of frogs creating infrasound when they croak. You know, they expand their throat. You know how their frogs, their throats expand? And if they can do that, like, against the ground, it actually can vibrate the ground and create infrasound. I don't know that they use that for communication. But anyway, just to be safe, I added the extra bit about stunning prey because I was pretty sure that that doesn't exist. But this is based on a real science story. Did anyone see this? Bob, did you see this story?
No, I didn't.
Okay,
so you were
just totally guessing. So they did discover a species of frog. I'm going to try to... it's Huia cavatympanum. And I think the name refers to the fact that this frog has a...
tympanic membrane?
That's right, a tympanic membrane, an ear. So most frogs have an ear membrane that's flush, a tympanic membrane flush with their skin. This frog has it recessed, which is much more mammalian in structure.
Yeah.
Researchers were able to show that this frog produces ultrasound and is probably communicating within the purely ultrasound frequency. Which means that researchers find in a new clinical study that 30% of cancers respond significantly to treatment with an antiviral drug is, in fact, science.
What the hell, man? Wow.
A very interesting finding. And this was actually a clinical trial. It's both basic and clinical research they were combining here. And although I did leave out a little bit of information to make it seem a little bit more suggestive, and I don't know if any of you assumed this, but it's not the antiviral effect that is helping the cancers.
Placebo.
It's a drug that happens to be an antiviral drug, but it's having some other pharmacological effect that's the anti-cancer effect.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you had to assume that, I guess.
I don't know if you all assumed that or if you were thinking it's treating a virus and that's helping the cancer. Now, I sort of let that implication lie without clarifying
wasn't
that.
Sure. Yeah.
So what's the deal? What's the deal, Steve?
The drug is ribavirin. Ribavirin is an antiviral drug, and it affects a gene product, the EIF4E gene, which has been shown in 30% of cancers to be dysfunctional and therefore probably contributing to the malignant character of the cancer itself, right? So it's dysregulated. This gene is dysregulated in 30% of cancers. And what ribavirin does is it suppresses the activity of this gene by mimicking its target, right? So it's sort of misdirecting its activity and inhibiting its overall activity. You know, cancer research these days is mainly about just continuous small incremental improvements.
Yeah.
You know, and this is one more step in the right direction.
Until the nanomedicine kicks in.
Are those infrasound pills we're going to take.
Right.
Now, if a frog could go, whoa, and cure cancer, that's the ticket right
that
there.
That would be cool. Right, then we could sell those frogs.
Could lick them.
You always got to take it there. Ed.
So, Evan, remind us what last week's Who's That Noisy was.
Here it is. And that, my friends, is a Doppler recording of a heart monitor that doctors use to check out a baby's heartbeat during a mother's pregnancy. So, yeah, lots of folks picked up on this one. And the first one to get it right was our friend Lump Couch from the message boards. So, well done.
Good job. So, what do you got for us this week?
So, whereas last week's was quite easy, this one should present a challenge. Here is Who's That Noisy?
So, of course, there's plenty of reaction to these kinds of things. There's lots of skeptical comments that basically say that there are billions of people out there with trillions of experiences, and so we hear the weird stuff. Occasionally, there's going to be an unusual coincidence, and those are the things that bubble up to the top. And so while the experience that I just read, which is a true experience, maybe it's a one in a trillion chance, but it's because there's all these other experiences that we don't hear about.
Okay. I gave you plenty of there to listen to. You got to figure out who is that speaking. Who's that noisy?
Because of these experiences, we have to get back to the beginning and talk about.
That was Jay's alter ego.
Yeah. I think Jay has an idea of who that is.
I think I do.
I think you do. But you'll have to tell me after the recording.
I have a raging clue.
All right, well, thanks, Evan.
You're welcome.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this evening?
We all know who Buddha is.
Yeah, Buddha.
Sure. He's the guy Gandhi prayed to, right?
He was a spiritual teacher in a northern region of Indian subcontinent who founded Buddhism. And I will read a quote from him. Do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many. Do not believe in anything simply because it is found written in your religious books. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Do not believe in traditions because they have been handed down for many generations. But after observation and analysis, when you find that anything agrees with reason and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. Buddha!
Oh, you scared me.
So, booyah! Cool quote, but we're supposed to believe him?
Booyah!
Yeah.
Well, if you think about the time frame that he lived, Bob, and you know that's a pretty serious skeptical quote
for somebody
going back that far.
For somebody in his time, yeah. And don't forget, guys, next week, SGU number 200.
Wow,
200.
Can you imagine?
Wow,
good times.
Good times.
Yeah. 200 episodes.
200.
Well, thanks again for joining me, guys.
No, thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.